in a high culture of the ancient world. He was born when the superpower Assyria was about to be replaced by Babylon. He lived to govern Babylon. And utterly amazingly, and perhaps unique in all of history, he lived to govern the subsequent empire of Medo-Persia. So we are to be talking about a man who knows more about power than any of us will ever know. A man who maintains not only his devotion to God, but who maintained his public witness to God. And they are not, of course, the same thing, are they? No doubt you have discovered, as you grow older, that it is much easier to maintain a private devotion to God than it is to maintain a public witness to God. It is so easy to retire into the safe Christian ghetto, to have relatively few non-Christian friends, to have no marketplace in which to witness. And so Daniel will be, to us, a constant challenge of what it means to witness to God in a pluralistic world. To fulfill, of course, that great task that God called Israel as a nation to do. In Daniel, we see it at its most magnificent. A man who believed God in control at the heart of a vast empire. In one sense, he is far beyond us. And the staggering thing is, he knew less than we did in one sense. He had no New Testament. He had no letters of Paul to guide him. He had some of the scriptures, particularly Jeremiah, which he loved. But God was with him. And he bore magnificent witness to God in his time. And my prayer for our weekend is that each of us may sense, not simply with our mind, but that is very important, but with our hearts, what motivated him, what it was that moved him to stand and witness in the way he did. It is fascinating when we look at the ancient world and see the cataclysm that was going on at the time. And this gives you some idea. Babylon is over here in contemporary Iraq. And there was a colossal battle, several battles in fact. Nineveh had fallen when Daniel was a child, perhaps 3 or 4 years old. And then in 605 BC, there was the Battle of Carchemish, there in the north on the river Euphrates, where the Egyptian army was defeated by Nebuchadnezzar on his way to ascendancy and power. A second battle in Egypt in the south deprived Pharaoh Necho of more of his power, and Babylon ascended as the superpower of the world that was contemporary to Daniel. And there in the middle was little Judah, Israel having long since been deported to Assyria. With a sequence of kings who were inept, inadequate, and who didn't really believe in God much anyway. And Judah was teetering, as the prophets had said, on ruin. And Nebuchadnezzar came and besieged it. And at the first siege, he removed the brightest of the nobility, including Daniel and his three friends. He came again a few years later and took thousands more. And not long after that, Jerusalem was sacked, and it appeared that Israel and Judah were no more. It was a fascinating time. And as Daniel in his old age takes up his pen to describe it, he starts like this. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylon, and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, and informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years. And after that, they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. To Daniel, the name Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, Shadrach. To Mishael, Meshach. And to Azariah, Abednego. A very brief description of cataclysmic events. I want you to imagine, so that you get some picture of what it may have been like. Daniel, probably as a teenager, maybe not older than 16, torn away from his parents, an involuntary brain drain, we could call it perhaps. Nebuchadnezzar was a far-sighted and brilliant man. He did not believe in wastage, especially of human intellectual and administrative power. So his habit was to take the brightest and the best of the nations which he conquered, and to take them and to put them through the University of Babylon at the highest level for the 3-year course. I often wonder whether Oxford and Cambridge got its 3-year degree from King's College Babylon, but that's another matter. And so Daniel arrived in Babylon. And it must have been spectacular after what he was used to in Judah. Jerusalem was a beloved city to him, but it was a small city. It had a magnificent temple, but that was about all. But Babylon, that was something different. It was a colossal city. Even at that time in the ancient world, its architecture was absolutely spectacular. The gate, the Ishtar gate through which Daniel would have gone, was stunning in its magnificence, with its ceramic tiles and its lions on those tiles going up the wall in all directions. And when he went through the gate, he would come to the processional way that led past buildings the like of which he had never in his wildest imagination believed could exist. The spectacular hanging gardens that Nebuchadnezzar had constructed for his wife, who was a country girl and missed the country, so he built the mountains in the city. It was one of the wonders of ancient architecture. The culture was brilliant. The architecture was unlike anything he'd ever seen. The buildings bigger. Their structures clever. And in the university, they were doing mathematics, which had such an impact on the world that most of you in this room have traces of it on your wrist. Are there not 60 minutes in an hour? And 60 seconds in a minute? Where does that come from, if not from Babylon, where the calculations were done not to the base 10, but base 60? Their medicine was incredible. They discovered the use of plants. And they had some very wise things to say about hygiene. Their libraries were all over the place. Their culture was of a spectacular kind. When people in England were running around in mud huts and had very little else to show for it. It's humbling of it, isn't it, sometimes to think of these things. We think of ourselves, perhaps, in the West as the cradle of civilization, but we're not. This is high culture, and it is important that we realize it, because it will bring it nearer to us in our contemporary world. And there are so many fascinating traces of it. There are, of course, the cuneiform, the wedge-shaped writings where they did their mathematics. It was difficult doing mathematics and architecture on clay tablets, but there it is. There are the drawings and the measurements for a ziggurat. And there are thousands of these tablets that are left. But some of the most fascinating ones are the ones that confirm the biblical history. And there are many of those. Here is an example of one. And if you can read it there, you will see that it says it is the Babylonian Chronicle for the years 605 to 594 BC. It includes the Battle of Carchemish, the accession of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and the appointment of Zedekiah as king of Judah after the capture of Jerusalem on the 16th of March 597 BC and the removal of the Judeans to exile in Babylon. A confirmation from ancient archaeology that what we are reading when we come to these biblical texts is not the product of somebody's fanciful imagination, but is in fact true history. It actually happened. But there is another thing we need to know about Babylon, and that is it was an incredibly religious place. It is reckoned that at the time of Daniel there were 1,197 temples in Babylon, which was a city of somewhere between 150,000, perhaps went up to 200,000 on festival days. In no other ancient society, so say the experts on Mesopotamia, was daily life so permeated by polytheism, a multiplicity of gods. And as you go round, you will discover that the gates and the temples were named after the gods. Look at them, the Ishtar gate, the Sin gate, the Marduk gate, the Enlil gate, the Shamash gate, and so on and so forth. And then the temple of Adad, the temple of Marduk, the temple of Shamash, to mention only the prominent one. It was a thoroughly idolatrous city. So we need to imagine Daniel leaving his monotheistic home, where he had been taught, presumably by his parents and teachers, that there is one true God, creator of heaven and earth, to suddenly find himself as a teenager amongst all the scintillating intellectual brilliance of this high culture, and yet a culture founded on and riddled through with idolatrous belief. That was strange, wasn't it? How could they get it so wrong? Or had they? What was wrong with it anyway? And Daniel was brought face to face for the first time in his life with the big world out there. Just as we, in our day, discover sometimes too slowly that there is a big world out there that does not share our belief in God or His Son, Jesus Christ. And as we shall see as we proceed, is almost as thoroughly riddled with idolatry as the ancient world was. But we shall come to that in good time. Let's stay then with some of the early lessons on this first evening. Because as Daniel writes in his very first sentence, he gives us an insight into the way he looks at history. And he emphasizes to us the importance of seeing history through God's eyes. You notice what he says in verse 2 of chapter 1, "And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand." That is Nebuchadnezzar's hand. Consider the situation. Here was God's temple in Jerusalem. It had no image in it. It was unique in the ancient world because it stood for the transcendent, imageless creator of heaven and earth. And Nebuchadnezzar, pagan emperor that he was, came to the temple, removed some of its most sacred treasures, and God did nothing. What would you have thought? And later, the temple was destroyed and God still did nothing. And the kings of the line of David were taken in chains to Babylon. Was this not Jerusalem, where God's name was supposed to be? Whose king was David, and of whose line there should be HaMashiach, the Messiah, coming one day? What then of God's promises? You can imagine, can't you, when Daniel turned up at Babylon, and he met his fellow students, Babylonian students, and students from all over the far-flung empire. And they asked him his name. "Oh, mine's Daniel." "It's what?" "Daniel." "That's a funny name, isn't it? That's not Babylonian, surely." "No, no, no, it isn't. It's a Hebrew name." "It's a what?" "What do you mean a Hebrew name? Who are the Hebrews?" "Well, I come from Jerusalem." "Oh yes, Jerusalem. That was the little city that Nebuchadnezzar bashed up a few months ago, wasn't it?" "Yes, well, you didn't have the weapons, did you? Pity, but anyway, you get on all right in Babylon. Daniel, you say, is your name. Well, it's nice to meet you, Daniel." "Your name, does it have a meaning?" "Well, actually it does. Dan-i-el. God is my judge." "What do you mean God is your judge? What God are you talking about? Are you talking about Marduk or Shamash or Enlil?" "No, no. I'm talking about the God who created the heavens and the earth." "Nonsense. There is no God who created the heavens and earth. I think you'll have to do philosophy course one and start at the bottom. Don't you realize that in Babylonia, the gods themselves were generated by the basic matter and stuff of the universe? You believe in God, a supreme creator? Yes, I do, says Daniel. Come on. I mean, how can you maintain that when your little country that claims it believes in God has been bashed up and smashed? What would you have said if you'd been Daniel? And what do you say today when your colleagues suggest to you that there is no God, when they see humanity being bashed and smashed and torn to ribbons in so many parts of this world, and nothing appears to happen? Do you have anything to say, gentlemen? Because if you don't, we'd better give up, hadn't we? Oh, it was very real. He was only 15. To have to go into that with only 3 friends and to stand for God against that pressure is magnificent. Utterly magnificent. And I trust, as we listen to what he cares to tell us, that we shall see not only history, but our contemporary society and ourselves through God's eyes. What was it saved his sanity at this point? It was because he believed Scripture. That's what it was. You see, the captivity of Judah had been predicted. And although it was a colossal shock to Daniel's system personally, because it meant he lost his parents and his home, presumably, and was wrenched into an alien country and became a refugee, nonetheless, it was what Jeremiah had said would happen, was it not? Because the God that Daniel believed in was a God who judged, as his name indicates, a God who was the God who was the foundation of morality and ethics, and to whom it matters how nations behave, even if they call themselves by his name. And Daniel maintained his faith because there was a word from God. It was written. It was written that if Judah, and before it Israel, compromised with idolatry, then they would end up at the home of idolatry, the punishment fitting the crime. The home of idolatry where Abram, their great patriarch, had originally come from. They would be forced to return to it to see what idolatry was really like. And so Daniel knew that the turning point had come. And so instead of breaking his faith, this cataclysm confirmed it. It is not always the pleasant things in life that confirm faith, is it? It is sometimes when life takes a turning that's on God's map that confirms it. But oh, there was something else, because we're racing too fast, aren't we? We need to pick up the clues. Because you see, before Daniel is ever mentioned, something else is. Odd it is, really, because you'll find it right at the very beginning. I wonder, would you have put it in if you'd been writing this book? We are told that Nebuchadnezzar took some of the articles from the temple of God, and these he carried off to Babylonia and put in the treasure house of his God. Why mention that?
Well, what were these articles? Well, we learn a little bit more about them in chapter 5 because they reappear. They reappear in spectacular form at Belshazzar's banquet. Vessels of gold that came from the temple of God in Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar stole them. But at least he had sufficient respect for them to put them in his, or one of his, magnificent museums. The treasure house of his God. If you go to Germany, there are many major cities in which the museum has what is called a Schatzkammer, a treasure house. And you will find the valuable vessels and artifacts of which the city and the museum are proud. And Nebuchadnezzar, like many other ancient monarchs, delighted to display the artifacts of the nations he had conquered. Of course he did. Because the more magnificent they were, the more it reflected glory upon him, because he had conquered the makers of them. It was as simple as that, wasn't it? And so the museums in Babylon were stuffed with exhibitions from all around the world of the work of the peoples that Nebuchadnezzar ruled over and that he had conquered. I don't know how large the exhibit on Judah was. I suspect it wasn't very large. But at least Nebuchadnezzar had the respect to put the vessels in the treasure house of his God. You will notice the repetition, won't you? They came from the temple of God. They now go to the treasure house of Nebuchadnezzar's God. We're being introduced to God and gods, aren't we? What's the basic idea? Oh, it is profoundly important. Because Daniel is giving us, in this picturesque way, an insight into something that was fundamental to him all his life long. Let's ask the simple question, what did those vessels mean to Daniel? They were made of gold, as God had commanded, in connection with the tabernacle first and then the temple subsequently. It was the most valuable metal they had. Still is for many people. A symbol of enduring value. It was them. It represented value. But what value? The temple at Jerusalem was inlaid with gold. And as the Sardis sat and reflected upon the magnificence of it, he said, every whit of it says glory. It was a symbol of the glory of God. It was a symbol of God as the unique value and determinator of values in this world. To Daniel it meant everything. And I can imagine that when he had the opportunity, he might well have gone down to the museum and stood looking in through the window at the exhibit and seeing those vessels which once had stood in the temple at Jerusalem and now they were just part of a subsection, marked Judah, in a vast, rambling museum. Can you see what that means? What does it mean? Well, let me put it this way. What Nebuchadnezzar had done was to take a symbol of absolute value and to relativize it. It was now just one among many, from many nations. And in that simple description of what Nebuchadnezzar did, Daniel opens for us a window into our society in the 21st century. Because one aspect of the pluralistic society that we have to contend with is that it is characterized by relativism of values. And Canada will vote, will it not, on the value of human life in the womb? Values, gentlemen, lie at the heart of many of our political debates. Because there is an intellectual battle and a moral battle. But in our particular contemporary society, it's not so much the question of the value of God, but the value of human beings. They are linked, of course. If you lose the glory and the value of God as your supreme value, you will end up by devaluing human beings. What are we doing to alert our society to it? Human beings don't like to be devalued, do they? Are we engaging in the debate? Are we seeking ways to discuss these issues because they go to the very heart of what we believe? If we believe it, as Daniel did. God, as a later prayer would put it, our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. That word hallowed captures it. Sacred, set apart, distinct, the unique value, the goal of Daniel's faith. And the secret of his life, gentlemen, one of the secrets anyway, was that as a compass bearing in life, God was his supreme value. Oh, that's easy to say. It's not so easy to live. Do you find it so? God is supreme value because the pressure is on to relativize God. Not only to relativize God, but to relativize truth until you get to the stage where there is no truth. And then what is believed is determined by those with the greatest power. But that's a story for later. We're still just at the beginning, aren't we? And so it's a question of values that we are facing here. From the temple of God in Jerusalem to the temple of his God. But there is another thing. You see, people never stop with relativizing the absolute, do they? What you'll discover in Daniel's book and in contemporary society is that once you lose the concept of God as absolute, and relativize God or dismiss him altogether, you will end up by absolutizing something that is relative. You will take something of relative value. Power, money, sex, and absolutize it. And so that's the battle. The lines are drawn, they're clear. It's the battle between the absoluteness of God, the pressure to relativize the absolute, and the simultaneous colossal pressure to absolutize the relative. How shall we stand? Well, the pressure was even greater than on Daniel. We've seen what Nebuchadnezzar's educational policy was. He took these men, that he was going to train them in the language and literature of Babylon for 3 years. You notice Daniel did not refuse the education. He was not a monk. He and his 3 friends were not for running away from society. I expect they had no choice anyway. But we do not get a hint of disapproval from heaven, do we? What a colossal risk to expose yourself to the secularism of this society and its language and its literature. But how else could you reach them? We need to learn to read. What our colleagues read, even if it's only the newspaper. We need to learn to think our way into their situation. And Daniel had 3 years of it. But there was something had to happen first at King's College Babylon. I said before that Nebuchadnezzar was a very clever man. And so the first thing that was done was that these men's names were changed. I just told you, haven't I, how that Daniel could have used his name as a marvelous opportunity to witness to God, and so could the others. Just look at their names. Hananiah, the Lord shows grace. You imagine the opportunity to explain to a Babylonian student what grace meant. Mishael, who is what God is? A name that could be turned into a question. Fascinating opportunity to talk to people. And Azariah, the Lord helps. A reflection of the fact that his parents believed that God was near to them as a family and God helped. Just imagine a discussion with those 4 men and what they could get out of their names. But it wasn't to be, was it? Because their names were changed. Daniel's name became Belteshazzar, which could possibly mean may Bel, that is one of the Babylonians' gods, protect his life. It could also mean, interestingly, the treasurer of Bel. Shadrach means the command of Aku, the moon god. And Meshach, which sounds, as you notice, like Mishael, was a very clever twisting of his Hebrew name. A parody of his name. Who is what Aku is? Instead of who is what God is. And Abednego, servant of the god Nabu. Changing their name. That's what they do at Babylon. It was brilliant, of course. Because, you see, it was meant to remove traces of their identity. Who are you? We've got a name. Mine's John. But I don't quite mean that. What is our identity? Well, that's a big question. Oh, it's a very big question. Because, you see, this question of identity is something that, well, it brings us back in history to the very origins of Babylon, doesn't it? Because this is Babylon, which is just a slight alteration of its original name, Babel. And we all know what Babel stood for. Let us build a city. Yes. But, and perhaps more importantly, let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad in the earth. Babel, Babylon, stands in the ancient world like a vast great pillar, commemorating the restless, eternal human search for identity and meaning.
Is that wrong?
Aren't you searching for meaning? Be honest. Don't you want a significance? This is a world in which we are increasingly be told that we as humans have no significance. The professor of modern European thought, a very influential writer in London University, has just written a book which is selling in hundreds of thousands. And he says that one of the implications of the fact that we are nothing but animals is that history has no meaning, and we have no meaning as humans outside of ourselves. Well, people are desperate for meaning. Babylon proved it. But let me come straight to the point. God took Abram out of that city. And what did he say to him? He said this: leave your country. I will make your name great. By the way, what was he looking for when he left the country? Well, later we read in Scripture that he was looking for the city which has the foundations, whose architect is God. What city is that? The New Jerusalem. So the tale of two cities, which is the Scripture, you see, is a very important idea. And it seems to me to be preaching a powerful message straight to my heart and mind. It's simply this. There are two ways of getting significance in life. The one is to make it for ourselves. And the other is to allow God to make it for us. Well, that's easy to say too, isn't it? But let's be honest, gentlemen. Do you ever wish you were someone else? Had somebody else's gifts, abilities, talents, money, power, influence, charm? Ever wrestled with your identity? I rarely meet a person who hasn't wrestled with their identity at one time or other. And here, in this book, it's presented to us the two sides. One pulls us up, the other down. The colossal pressure in our world to create your own identity. To be, in the hackneyed phrase, a self-made man. And the other, which for many is a deep battle, which can go on for years maybe, to accept the identity that God has given us. It's not always easy, is it? Not always easy. And yet there's great encouragement here. There's great encouragement as we finish our first session. Daniel's name and that of his friends may have been lost, but Daniel's name was not forgotten. The name Daniel, you know, survived the Babylonian Empire that had changed it to Belteshazzar.